It's part of my strong feeling for the necessity of constant change, for keeping people a little off balance. A lot of folks in my position would have been perfectly content with the situation as it stood in 1984. Our 640 Walmarts were earning almost $200 million a year on sales of more than $4.5 billion. We were still growing like wildfire, and we were underway with Sam's. But I felt like we had to make a change. So I called in Jack Shoemaker, by now our president and chief operating officer, and asked him if he would mind swapping jobs with David Glass, our chief financial officer. Not your everyday request from the chairman in most companies, I guess. I valued the talents of both of these guys enormously. But I had my own reasons for wanting to see how the switch might work out. Jack is so smart and aggressive and sure of himself that sometimes he could be a little rough on folks, and I wanted to see how somebody with David's smoother manner would handle the job. Jack said he already knew he didn't want to stay at Walmart until he was an old man, so after some discussion we agreed on the switch. David took the president's job, and Jack stayed on for 3 more years as chief financial officer, and he did a great job. Today he does international consulting work, and he remains a valuable Walmart board member. David, of course, turned into a fantastic president, and about 5 years ago I relinquished my CEO title to him. At that time, Jack retired. As well as all that worked out for everyone, and it really did, I won't pretend there wasn't tension surrounding that period in our history. This is a highly competitive business, and an even more competitive company. It naturally attracts a lot of ambitious people, sometimes with egos to match. Ever since my peewee football days, I've believed almost any kind of competition is great. I expect our folks to compete with one another, and as I have said, what I hate is to see a rivalry become a personal thing, where the folks don't support one another. Competition is actually the reason I love retailing so much. The Walmart story is just another chapter in that history of competition. A great chapter, mind you. But it's all part of the evolution of the industry. There's always a challenger coming along. There may be one on the street right now formulating a plan to get to the top. To stay ahead of those challengers, we have to keep changing and looking back over our shoulder and planning ahead. That's one reason we bought the McLane Company a few years ago. It's a big distributor to grocery stores, and it should be a great base for us to push on into that market where we feel customers are ready for our way of doing business. Right now, I see a lot of new challengers coming from offshore with some very sophisticated programs. Some of the emerging competitors in this country, who have come from Holland, Germany, and France, bear close watching. And it won't be long before we have a wave of Japanese retail concepts arriving. I don't know if Walmart can truly maintain our leadership position by just staying in this country. I think we're going to have to become a more international company in the not-too-distant future. We've created an international division in the company, and we have a joint venture with a Mexican company called Cifra, for the development of Club Aurrera, a wholesale club concept. We've opened 2 with plans for more soon. Absorbing people from other cultures quickly and smoothly into the company will present a real challenge to Walmart in the near future. But our folks are up to it. On the domestic front, competition in the discount business has improved tremendously in the last few years. Our competitors are doing a better job of serving their customers, of getting them through the checkout lines. They're running cleaner stores with better merchandise presentations. They're making our job a lot harder. But so far, none of our competitors has yet been able to operate on the volume that we do as efficiently as we do. They haven't been able to get their expense structure as low as ours, and they haven't been able to get their associates to do all those extra things for their customers that ours do routinely. Greeting them, smiling at them, helping them, thanking them. And they haven't been able to move their merchandise as efficiently or keep it in stock as efficiently as we do. If anyone is ever able to top us in any of those areas, we will have real concern. At this point, no one has been able to do it. Chapter 14 Expanding the Circles. Distribution and transportation have been so successful at Walmart because senior management views this part of the company as a competitive advantage, not as some afterthought or necessary evil. And they support it with capital investment. A lot of companies don't want to spend any money on distribution unless they have to. Ours spends because we continually demonstrate that it lowers our costs. This is a very important strategic point in understanding Walmart. Joe Harden, Executive Vice President, Logistics and Personnel. Some of our guys around here find it amusing that I get so much credit for Walmart's reputation as a world leader in retailing and distribution technology. It's not because we're not on the cutting edge. We are. They're amused because, as I told you, ever since I went to that IBM school in 1966, I've put up a pretty good fight every time somebody wants to buy some new system for this, that, or the other. I want them to think hard about how they're going to justify the expense before they even come to me with it. But there's no question about it. One of the main reasons we've been able to roll this company out nationally was all the pressure put on me by guys like David Glass and earlier Jack Shoemaker and Ron Mayer to invest so heavily in technology. Yes, I argued and resisted, but I eventually signed the checks, and we have been able to move way out front of the industry in both communications and distribution. During that period in the late 70s, when Kmart's management had such a strong resistance to any kind of change, that resistance included investment in systems. At the same time, our fellows were just absolutely convinced that computers were essential to managing growth and keeping down our cost structure. Today, of course, they've been proven so right that they look like geniuses. I would go so far as to say, in fact, that the efficiencies and economies of scale we realize from our distribution system gave us one of our greatest competitive advantages. Many people have contributed over the years, but David Glass has to get the lion's share of the credit for where we are today in distribution. David had a vision for automated distribution centers, linked by computer both to our stores and to our suppliers. And he set about building such a system beginning in 1978 at Searcy, Arkansas. David Glass. Searcy probably was built about 2 years later than we needed it, so there was a lot of pressure on us to get it up and running. The big knock on Walmart was that we weren't going to be able to expand much beyond the 350-mile ring around our distribution center in Bentonville. Because of that logistical problem, our disbelievers said we would always be a medium-sized regional retailer confined to this area. I pushed hard for Searcy as the solution. It was a real ambitious plan. Our first remote mechanized distribution center. Unfortunately, we needed it so badly that we had to rush it into service, and the crunch turned it into a disaster, my disaster. It was as bad as Sam's opening at Harrison, only more serious. We were shipping freight out of there before we had a roof on the building, and nothing, not even the toilets, worked like it was supposed to. We had guys like Glenn Hayburn, our data processing manager, and Paul Carter down there driving forklifts, until Hayburn tore down a rack and spilled Listerine all over the place. Working conditions were terrible. And the next thing you know, the union was down there organizing. It was such a nightmare that Sam began to question the whole idea of mechanized distribution. He really wasn't sure it worked at all. Fortunately, he hired Don Soderquist from Ben Franklin around that time, and Don came in as a big supporter of what we were trying to do. He believed in mechanized distribution all the way. And he eventually took over distribution from me in 1980. He went on to do a great job expanding it, helping introduce a lot of innovation, including a badly needed new inventory management system. Fortunately, we turned Circe around and made it work because it saved our neck after we took on all those Coon stores. We had to figure out how to supply them, and our arrangement with a third-party distributor turned into a nightmare. So we built an addition at Circe to service them, and it solved the problem. Circe, which is one of our best-performing distribution centers today, really was the key to our whole distribution system. After we proved it would work, we were able to duplicate the model anywhere. And that's what we've done. I think it's fair to say that our distribution system today is the envy certainly of everyone in our industry, and in a lot of others as well. We now have 20 of these centers placed strategically in our trade areas around the country, still mostly within a day's drive, or about 350 miles, of the stores they serve. Combined, they account for more than 18 million square feet of distribution space. We stock over 80,000 items in our stores, and our warehouses directly replenish almost 85% of their inventory, compared to only about 50 to 65% for our competition. As a result, the gap from the time our in-store merchants place their computer orders until they receive replenishment averages only about 2 days. That probably compares to 5 or more days for a lot of our competitors, which don't ship as much merchandise through their own network. The time savings and flexibility are great, but the cost savings alone would make the investment worthwhile. Our costs run less than 3% to ship goods to our stores, while it probably costs our competitors between 4.5% to 5% to get those same goods to their stores. The math is pretty simple. If we both sell the same goods for the same price at retail, we'll earn 2.5% more profit than they will right there. Joe Harden. When you own and manage your distribution and logistics channel, you have a great competitive advantage over companies that rely on third-party suppliers. It automatically shortens your lead times, but also you can constantly look for ways to improve your operation and try to make it more efficient. You never have to rely on what's going on in somebody else's shop. In our case, we generally know where things are in relationship to when we want them to arrive, so we can schedule and plan to move goods into the stores at the right time. That maximizes our in-stock positions, which is vital. You can't generate sales unless you have the product there when the customer wants it. Not only do we stack more of our merchandise in our own distribution centers, we also rely on our own private truck fleet to a much greater degree than our competitors do. Our private fleet is one of the nation's largest, maybe the largest. Last year, David asked Lee Scott, our vice president who oversees transportation, to try and locate every truck and trailer in the fleet on a single day just to show that we could do it. Of course he did, and at last count, Lee says we have more than 2,000 over-the-road tractors and more than 11,000 trailers. Unlike both Kmart and Target, which contract out with third parties to deliver a lot of freight from their distribution centers, we've always felt that we needed our own fleet. To have the kind of flexibility we want, that ability to respond above and beyond what we could ask some outsider to do for us, we need drivers who are part of our team. Drivers who are as dedicated to serving our customers as the associates in the stores. And man, do we ever have them. When you're out on the highway and you pass by a Walmart truck, you can bet your bottom dollar that the guy behind the wheel is a true professional. He's not just driving a truck. He's dedicated to servicing those stores. And he knows he's an ambassador of Walmart and everything we stand for out on the road. I'll just say it. We have the best damn truck drivers in America, and their loyalty and their can-do attitude have made a huge difference to this company. Lee Scott. Our drivers really are extremely loyal to their mission, which is to serve the stores. They report back to Walmart continually on things like merchandise thrown out behind the store that looked like it was good, attitude and morale problems in the stores. For a long, long time, Sam would show up regularly in the driver's break room at 4 a.m. with a bunch of donuts and just sit there for a couple of hours talking to them. He grilled them. What are you seeing at the stores? Have you been to that store lately? How do the people act there? Is it getting better? It makes sense. The drivers see more stores every week than anybody else in this company. And I think what Sam likes about them is that they're not like a lot of managers. They don't care who you are. They'll tell you what they really think. Of course, the only thing that makes the whole distribution system work so well is the dedication of the people all across it. The technology and hardware are just tools. The people in the system believe just as firmly as the associates in the stores that their primary job is to take care of the customer. Except in their case, the customer is the Walmart store or Sam's Club they're supplying. With that idea at the root of everything, we've developed a unique ability to customize what we do to meet the needs of our stores. Until recently, for example, we bragged that we were making deliveries every day to 97% of our stores. Then we discovered that wasn't necessarily the best thing for all of our stores, particularly the smaller ones. So now we've gone into a customized delivery system in which stores can pick one of four different delivery plans. Every 6 months, each store decides which plan it prefers. And we also have a plan called Accelerated Delivery, designed for stores located within a certain distance of a distribution center. A store in that plan can order merchandise on Monday night and get it on Tuesday night. Nobody else in the business can deliver like that on any kind of widespread basis. When all this comes together at one of our distribution centers, it's really a sight to behold. You really have to see one of these places in action to appreciate them. And sometimes I can hardly believe them myself. But I'll try to describe the activity at one. Start with a building of about 1.1 million square feet, which is about as much floor space as 23 football fields, sitting out somewhere on some 150 acres. Fill it high to the roof with every kind of merchandise you can imagine, from toothpaste to TVs, toilet paper to toys, bicycles to barbecue grills. Everything in it is barcoded, and a computer tracks the location and movement of every case of merchandise, while it's stored and when it's shipped out. Some 600 to 800 associates staff the place. which runs around the clock 24 hours a day. On one side of the building is a shipping dock with loading doors for around 30 trucks at a time, usually full. On the other side is the receiving dock, which may have as many as 135 doors for unloading merchandise. These goods move in and out of the warehouse on some 8.5 miles of laser-guided conveyor belts, which means that the lasers read the barcodes on the cases and then direct them to whatever truck is filling the order placed by one of the stores it's servicing that night. On a heavy day, those belts might handle up to 200,000 cases of goods. When the thing is running full speed, it's just a blur of boxes and crates flying down those belts, red lasers flashing everywhere, directing this box to that truck or that box to this truck. Out in the parking lot, whole packs of Walmart trucks rumble in and out all day. I get tremendously excited going out to those centers, talking with our associates and drinking coffee with them and the truck drivers. It's amazing to me how many ideas they always have for fine-tuning the system. If you get the idea that I'm awfully proud of what we've managed to do in distribution, you're right. To get the whole picture, though, it's important to realize that the same thing is happening simultaneously at 19 other almost identical distribution centers every day. Not only that, for us to continue expanding the way we do, we have to constantly plan the construction and staffing of more and more of these giant mechanized warehouses. And that's no small task for Joe Harden and his folks. We'll probably have 30 in operation in just the next few years. They're already on the drawing boards. From the time David Glass came on board in 1976, he's been pushing me to invest and invest and invest in that system. And thank goodness he managed to be so persuasive. At the same time, he and Jack Shoemaker were also pushing hard for heavy investment and more, better and better computer systems, so that we could track sales and merchandise and inventories across the company, especially in-store transactions. When Jack became our president and chief operating officer in 1978, he worked really hard at getting me to invest in barcoding and SKU item control, which is a computerized stock-keeping unit inventory system. Jack also was heavily involved in the creation of our satellite system, which turned out to be another one of our tremendous competitive advantages. Jack Shoemaker. Glenn Hayburn was our data processing manager, and he and I had this dream of an interactive communication system on which you could communicate back and forth between all the stores and the distribution centers and the general office. Glenn came up with the idea of using the satellite, and I said, "Let's pursue it without asking anybody." So we got it to the point where we were ready to make a proposal, and we told Sam. He just listened. He didn't necessarily discourage me, but he didn't encourage me either. Sam never gets excited about systems. The technology didn't really exist to do this for a retailer in the early 80s, but we got together with the Makem and Hughes Corporation and worked out a contract, and eventually we committed $24 million to build it. We launched it in 1983, and I mean Sam liked to kill me the first few years. It was not an immediate success, but we got it working, and now, of course, everybody has one. The satellite turned out to be absolutely necessary because once we had those scanners in the stores, we had all this data pouring into Bentonville over phone lines. Those lines have a limited capacity, so as we added more and more stores, we had a real logjam of stuff coming in from the field. As you know, I like my numbers as quickly as I can get them. The quicker we get that information, the quicker we can act on it. The system has been a great tool for us, and our technical people have done a terrific job of figuring out how to use it to our best advantage. Jack is absolutely right about me and systems, though. I rarely get excited about them. A few years ago, we built this huge building right next to our main offices, around 135,000 square feet, just to house the computers, and everyone at the time told me how much room we'd have to grow. I mean, it was really empty in there just 2 or 3 years ago. Well, already, it's completely full of computer equipment. And when I look back, it's no wonder. We've spent almost $700 million building up the current computer and satellite systems we have. I'm told it's the largest civilian database of its kind in the world. Even bigger than AT&T's. None of that matters to me. What I like about it is the kind of information we can pull out of it on a moment's notice. All those numbers. For one thing, we keep a 65-week rolling history of every single item we stock in Walmart or Sam's. That means I can pick anything, say a little combination TV VCR like I use here in my office, and tell you exactly how many of them we bought over the last year and a quarter, and exactly how many of them we've sold. Not only overall, but in any or every region, every district, every store. It makes it tough for a vendor to know more about how his product is doing in our stores than we do. I guess we've always known that information gives you a certain power, but the degree to which we can retrieve it in our computer really does give us the power of competitive advantage. I can walk in that satellite room where our technicians sit in front of their computer screens, talking on the phone to any stores that might be having a problem with the system, and just looking over their shoulder for a minute or two will tell me a lot about how a particular day is going. Up on the screen, I can see the total of the day's bank credit card sales adding up as they occur. I can see how many stolen bank cards we've retrieved that day. I can tell if our 7-second credit card approval system is working as it should be, and monitor the number of transactions we conducted that day. If we have something really important or urgent to communicate to the stores and distribution centers, something important enough to warrant a personal visit, I, or any other Walmart executive, can walk back to our TV studio and get on that satellite transmission and get it right out there. And as I told you earlier, I can go in every Saturday morning around 3, look over those printouts, and know precisely what kind of week we've had. So you see, technology and distribution are every bit as important to Walmart's ability to grow and maintain control as you may have heard or read over the years. But when you see all those satellite dishes outside our building, or hear about all the computers inside it, or look at some videotape of our laser-guided distribution centers, don't let anybody kid you. Without the right managers and the dedicated associates and truck drivers all across the system, all that stuff is totally worthless. Chapter 15. Thinking Small. Well, now, Sam, how big do you really want this company to be? What is your plan? Farrelled Arendt, shortly after coming to work at Walmart. Farrelled, we're going to take it as it comes. And if we can grow with our own money, we'll maybe add a store or two. Sam Walton. Not long ago, somebody showed me an article written for a local magazine in 1960. It was called Success Story of the Year, and it described how we had built up an empire of 9 variety stores. Then it quoted me as saying that we probably wouldn't grow much more because I believed in personally supervising the 9-store group, and I thought any more stores would be unwieldy to manage without additional supervisors. So what the heck happened? How did we ever get to be the largest retailer in the world with a philosophy like that? I really believed what I said then, and I still do. But we figured out a way to grow and stay profitable, and there is no logical place to stop. The way I approached managing the business, I always tried to maintain a sense of hands-on personal supervision, usually by flying around to take a look at our stores on a regular basis. But from the very beginning, even on my paper routes in college, I have also been a delegator, trying to hire the best possible people to manage our stores. That's been the case since back in Newport. An awful lot of water has washed over the dam since 1945, when we bought that little Front Street store in Newport. But almost every single thing we learned, every basic principle we applied in building that store up into a respectable business, still applies to our company today. It's hard to think of another company that sustained the kind of growth we did over 30 years without experiencing any major financial problems or dips in profitability. During that time, our business was growing at annual rates of anywhere from 30 to an incredible 70% in some years. Along the way, we always had lots of people waiting for us to stumble and fall, especially Wall Street types. They said we'd never be able to keep doing things our way after we reached $1 billion in sales. But we did, and kept right on going. Then they said everything would fall apart at $10 billion because you just couldn't manage a company that big with our little down-home management philosophies. We roared past that, and then hit $20 billion and $30 billion. And in the coming year, we should hit around $53 billion. 2 years ago, we earned $1 billion in profits for the first time. That's a jump from only $41 million just 10 years before. So now we're the largest retailer in the world, and still growing like a weed. If my chart doesn't paint a clear enough picture for you of how large the company is, here are some other ways to think about Walmart's size. Every week, nearly 40 million people shop in Walmart. Last year, we sold enough men's and women's underwear and socks to put a pair on every person in America, with some to spare. We sold 135 million men's and boys' briefs, 136 million panties, and 280 million pairs of socks. We sold one quarter of all the fishing line purchased in the United States, some 600,000 miles of it, or enough to go around the earth 24 times. We sold 55 million sweatsuits and 27 million pairs of jeans, and we sold almost 20% of all the telephones bought in the U.S. And here's one I'm really proud of. In 1 week last year, we sold as much Old Roy private label dog food as we did in all of 1980. With sales of $200 million last year, Old Roy became the number two dog food in America. And remember, we only sell it in Walmart. Another one. Procter & Gamble sells more product to Walmart than it does to the whole country of Japan. I could go on and on, but you get the idea. We're big. Really big. That's not something I like to focus on. I always wanted to be the best retailer in the world, not necessarily the biggest. In fact, as I said in that article 30-something years ago, I've always been a little bit afraid that big might get in the way of doing a good job. Of course, being this big has some real advantages. Until we reached $1 billion, a lot of suppliers and vendors just ignored us way out here in the Arkansas outback. For years, some suppliers wouldn't even call on us. Now, of course, we're too big to ignore. But being big also poses dangers. It has ruined many a fine company, including some giant retailers, who started out strong and got bloated or out of touch or were slow to react to the needs of their customers. Here's the point. The bigger Walmart gets, the more essential it is that we think small. because that's exactly how we have become a huge corporation, by not acting like one. Above all, we are small-town merchants, and I can't tell you how important it is for us to remember, when we puff up our chests and brag about all those huge sales and profits, that they were all made one day at a time, one store at a time, mostly by the hard work, good attitude, and teamwork of all those hourly associates and their store managers, as well as by all those folks in the distribution centers. If we ever get carried away with how important we are because we are a great big $50 billion chain, instead of one store in Blytheville, Arkansas, or Macomb, Mississippi, or Oak Ridge, Tennessee, then you probably can close the book on us. If we ever forget that looking a customer in the eye and greeting him or her and asking politely if we can be of help is just as important in every Walmart today as it was in that little Ben Franklin in Newport, then we just ought to go into a different business, because we'll never survive in this one. Bill Fields. I'm sure that our whole focus on thinking small all relates to Sam running that store in Newport, where he was the entrepreneur and he was out there involved as a leader of the community. He sees that entrepreneurial element as being so important and something he never wants us to lose. He saw the big change in Ben Franklin and all those other companies that lost it because they got too big and distracted, and he's just determined it won't happen here. For us, thinking small is a way of life, almost an obsession. And I suspect thinking small is an approach that almost any business could profit from. The bigger you are, the more urgently you probably need it. At our size today, there's all sorts of pressure to regiment and standardize and operate as a centrally driven chain, where everything is decided on high and passed down to the stores. In a system like that, there's absolutely no room for creativity. No place for the maverick merchant that I was in the early days at Ben Franklin. No call for the entrepreneur or the promoter. Man, I'd hate to work at a place like that. And I worry every single day about Walmart becoming that way. I stay on these guys around here all the time about it. Of course, all those vendors and suppliers would love to see us get that way. It would make their jobs a lot simpler, for sure. If anybody at Walmart thinks we as a company are immune to big disease, I wish they'd just pack up and leave right now, because it's always something we'll have to worry about. For several decades now, we've worked hard at building a company that's simple and streamlined and takes its directions from the grassroots. It's a pretty tall order for an outfit that's spreading out all over the country as fast as we are. But along the way, we've learned some practical things about thinking small and developed some principles that have had a big effect on our company's success. Before you can fully understand how we got where we are today, it's important to understand these principles. Then you can recognize how we've applied them all along the way in the building of the company. Seeing how we've done some of these things might help other folks out there who face the same challenge of growing their business without losing touch with the customer. There's nothing at all profound about any of our principles. In fact, they're all common sense, and most of them can be found in any number of books or articles on management theory, many of which I've read and studied over the years. But I think the way we've applied them at Walmart has been just a little different. Here are six of the more important ways we at Walmart try to think small. Think one store at a time. That sounds easy enough, but it's something we've constantly had to stay on top of. Because our sales and earnings keep going up doesn't mean that we're smarter than everyone else, or that we can make it happen because we're so big. What it means is that our customers are supporting us, If they stopped, our earnings would simply disappear, and we'd all be out looking for new jobs. So we know what we have to do. Keep lowering our prices, keep improving our service, and keep making things better for the folks who shop in our stores. That's not something we can simply do in some general way. It isn't something we can command from the executive offices because we want it to happen. We have to do it store by store, department by department, customer by customer, associate by associate. For example, we've got one store in Panama City, Florida, and another only 5 miles away in Panama City Beach. But actually, they're worlds apart when it comes to their merchandise mix and their customer base. They're entirely different kinds of stores. One is built for tourists going to the beach, and the other is more like the normal Walmart, built for folks who live in town. That's why we try our best to put a merchant in charge of each store and to develop other merchants as the heads of each department in those stores. If the merchandise mix is really going to be right, it has to be managed by the merchandisers there on the scene, the folks who actually deal face-to-face with the customers day in and day out through the seasons. That makes it management's job to listen to those merchandisers out in the stores. We have these buyers here in Bentonville, 218 of them, and we have to remind them all the time that their real job is to support the merchants in the stores. Otherwise, you have a headquarters-driven system that's out of touch with the customers of each particular store. And you end up with a bunch of unsold work boots, overalls, and hunting rifles at the Panama City Beach store, where folks are begging for water guns and fishing rods and pails and shovels. And at the Panama City store in town, you've got a bunch of unsold beach gear stacked up gathering dust. So when we sit down at our Saturday morning meetings to talk about our business, we like to spend time focusing on a single store and how that store is doing against a single competitor in that particular market. We talk about what that store is doing right, and we look at what it's doing wrong. David Glass. We believe that we have to talk about and examine this company in minute detail. I don't know any other large retail company, Kmart, Sears, Penny's, that discusses their sales at the end of the week in any smaller breakdown than by region. We talk about individual stores, which means that if we're talking about the store in Dothan, Alabama, or Harrisburg, Illinois, everybody here is expected to know something about that store. How to measure its performance, whether a 20% increase is good or bad, what the payroll is running, who the competitors are, and how we're doing. We keep the company's orientation small by zeroing in on the smallest operating unit we have. No other company does that. Focusing on a single store can accomplish a number of things. First, of course, it enables us to actually improve that store. But if in the process we also happen to learn a particular way in which that Panama City Beach Walmart is outsmarting the competition on, say, beach towels, then we can quickly get that information out to all our other beach stores around the country and see if their approach works everywhere. Which brings us to the next principle. Communicate. Communicate, communicate. If you had to boil down the Walmart system to one single idea, it would probably be communication, because it is one of the real keys to our success. We do it in so many ways, from the Saturday morning meeting to the very simple phone call to our satellite system. The necessity for good communication in a big company like this is so vital, it can't be overstated. What good is figuring out a better way to sell beach towels if you aren't going to tell everybody in your company about it? If the folks in St. Augustine, Florida, don't get the word on what's working over in Panama City until winter, They've missed a big opportunity. And if our buyers back in Bentonville don't know we're expecting to double our sales of beach towels this summer, the stores won't have anything to sell. Nowadays, I see management articles about information sharing as a new source of power in corporations. We've been doing this from the days when we only had a handful of stores. Back then, we believed in showing a store manager every single number relating to his store. And eventually, we began sharing those same numbers with the department heads in our stores. We've kept doing it as we've grown. That's why we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on computers and satellites to spread all the little details around the company as fast as possible. But they were worth the cost. It's only because of information technology that our store managers have a really clear sense of how they're doing most of the time. They get all kinds of information transmitted to them over the satellite on an amazingly timely basis. Their monthly profit and loss statement, up-to-the-minute point-of-sale data that tells them what's selling in their own store, and a lot of other paper they probably wish we wouldn't send them. I'm not going to pretend we're perfect at this. We do have our share of miscommunication. Like that time the moon pies were shipped to stores in Wisconsin, where they didn't exactly jump off the shelves. And sometimes a simple attitude is as valuable as all the technology in the world. For example, we've got this one rule I hope we never give up enforcing. Our buyers here in Bentonville are required to return calls from the stores first before they return the calls of vendors or anybody else. And they are required to get back to the stores by sundown of the day they get the call. Obviously, we're too doggone big to have every department head in every Walmart spend a lot of time with the vendors who call on us in Bentonville, so we try to think up ways to get at a similar result. Now, recently, we've started seminars for our department managers. We'll pick a department like sporting goods or lawn and garden. Then we'll pick one department head. These are the hourly associates who actually run those departments in their stores from each of our store districts. That's 184 folks right now. We'll bring all of them into Bentonville to talk to the buyers about what's working for them and what's not. Then they meet with the vendors and explain what kinds of complaints we're getting about their products or what's working well. Together, all these folks formulate their plan for the coming season, and then the department heads go back to their districts and share what they've learned with their counterparts in neighboring stores. As much as we travel to our stores and bring our folks into Bentonville, though, sometimes I have the feeling that the word is not getting out. And if it's on a subject I feel strongly enough about, I'm not above getting in front of one of our TV cameras here and going out by satellite to all our associates gathered in front of their TVs in the break rooms of our stores. A few years ago, I had an idea around Christmas time that was just burning me up to tell people about, so I went on the camera and visited with everybody about how our sales were doing, and talked a little about my hunting, and let them know that I hoped their holiday season was going well. Then I got to the point. I don't think any other retail company in the world could do what I'm going to propose to you. It's simple. It won't cost us anything. And I believe it would just work magic. Absolute magic on our customers, and our sales would escalate. And I think we'd just shoot past our Kmart friends in a year or two, and probably Sears as well. I want you to take a pledge with me. I want you to promise that whenever you come within 10 feet of a customer, you will look him in the eye, greet him, and ask him if you can help him. Now, I know some of you are just naturally shy, and maybe don't want to bother folks, but if you'll go along with me on this, it would, I'm sure, help you become a leader. It would help your personality development. you would become more outgoing, and in time, you might become manager of that store. You might become a department manager. You might become a district manager, or whatever you choose to be in the company. It will do wonders for you. I guarantee it. Now I want you to raise your right hand and remember what we say at Walmart, that a promise we make is a promise we keep. And I want you to repeat after me. From this day forward, I solemnly promise and declare that every time a customer comes within 10 feet of me, I will smile, look him in the eye, and greet him. So help me, Sam. Now, I had no way of knowing how much effect a little communication like that would have on our associates or on our customers. But I felt so strongly about the idea that it was worth calling attention to it by satellite, and I really meant it when I said I didn't think any other retailer in the country could do it. I do know this. A lot of our associates started doing what I suggested, and I'm sure a lot of our customers appreciated it. We used mass communications to transmit the idea, but it was a small idea, aimed at the folks on the front lines, the ones most responsible for keeping our customers happy and coming back to our stores over and over. And I'm not saying one way or another whether my little pep talk had anything to do with it. But we went on from that Christmas to pass both Kmart and Sears in sales at least 2 years before even the most optimistic Wall Street analyst thought we could do it. Keep your ear to the ground. As chairman of Walmart, I, of course, was the one who ultimately authorized all those expenditures for technology, which proved absolutely crucial to our success. But truthfully, I never viewed computers as anything more than necessary overhead. A computer is not, and never will be, a substitute for getting out in your stores and learning what's going on. In other words, a computer can tell you down to the dime what you've sold, but it can never tell you how much you could have sold. That's why we at Walmart are just absolute fanatics about our managers and buyers getting off their chairs here in Bentonville and getting out into those stores. We have 12 airplanes, only one of them a jet, I'm proud to say, and our hangars out at the Rogers, Arkansas airport, and that's why they're there. We stay in the air to keep our ear to the ground. Our whole travel system is really an outgrowth of the way I managed those 9 stores back in 1960 when I said I didn't want to grow anymore. Back then, as you now know, I would get in my old tri-pacer and fly to those stores once a week to find out what was selling and what wasn't, what the competition was up to, what kind of job our managers were doing, what the stores were looking like, what the customers had on their minds. Of course, I've continued to visit stores almost constantly ever since, and it is the part of my job I enjoy the most, the part where I feel I make the greatest contribution. But with almost 2,000 stores today, a lot of other folks have to get in on the act with me. Today, the idea is pretty much the same. Our district managers are doing the job that I did back in 1960, the real hands-on, get-down-in-the-store stuff. But also, we have 18 regional managers, all of them based here in Bentonville. Every Monday morning, they pile into those airplanes and head across the country to the stores in their regions. It's a condition of their employment. They stay out 3 to 4 days, usually coming back in on Thursday. We've drummed into their heads the belief that they should come back with at least one idea that will pay for the trip. Then they gather with the senior management of the company, all of whom should also have been visiting stores earlier in the week, if they expect to ask any intelligent questions or know the first thing about what's going on, for our Friday morning merchandising meeting. In addition to the field work, of course, we have computer printouts at the meetings which tell us what's selling and what's not. But the really valuable intelligence that surfaces in these sessions is what everybody has brought back from the stores. If they're doing their jobs right, they'll know why things are or aren't selling, and what we ought to be thinking about selling next or dropping from our assortment. If they've been to that Panama City Beach store and seen a suntan cream display that's blowing the stuff out the door, they can share that with the other regionals for their beach stores. Or if they've been to a big store in the Rio Grande Valley and found out that we're getting beat by a competitor on ladies' dresses because their assortment is more suited to the particular taste of that area, we can start fixing it. When that meeting is over, every one of those regionals should be on the phone to the district managers, who should be passing the word along to the store managers, who'll get the department managers to act on it right away. David Glass. Our Friday merchandising meeting is unique to retailing, as far as I can tell. Here we have all these regional managers who've been out in the field all week long. They are the operations guys who direct the running of the stores. Then you have all your merchandising folks back in Bentonville, the people who buy for the stores. In retailing, there has always been a traditional head-to-head confrontation between operations and merchandising. You know, the operations guys say, "Why in the world would anybody buy this? It's a dog, and we'll never sell it." Then the merchandising folks say, "There's nothing wrong with that item. If you guys were smart enough to display it well and promote it properly, it would blow out the doors." That's the way it is everywhere, including Walmart. So we sit all these folks down together every Friday at the same table and just have at it. We can get into some of the doggonest knockdown dragouts you have ever seen. But we have a rule. We never leave an item hanging. We will make a decision in that meeting, even if it's wrong, and sometimes it is. But when the people come out of that room, you would be hard-pressed to tell which ones oppose it and which ones are for it. And once we've made that decision on Friday, we expect it to be acted on in all the stores on Saturday. What we guard against around here is people saying, "Let's think about it." We make a decision, then we act on it. Now, once these regional managers have come back on Thursdays, we load up the planes with some buyers and send them out to visit the individual stores. As we've gotten bigger, we've added on all kinds of ways to keep our buyers responsive to the store needs. These days, we've got folks called regional buyers who go around and help the store managers customize the merchandise for their own stores. My favorite buyer program is one called Eat What You Cook. Once a quarter, every buyer has to go out to a different store and act as manager for a couple of days in the department he or she buys merchandise for. I guarantee you that after they've eaten what they cooked enough times, these buyers don't load up too many moon pies to send to Wisconsin or beach towels for Hiawatha, Kansas. Push responsibility and authority down. The bigger we get as a company, the more important it becomes for us to shift responsibility and authority toward the front lines, toward that department manager who's stocking the shelves and talking to the customer. When we were much smaller, I probably wasn't as quick to catch on to this idea as I should have been, but as an avid student of management theory back in the mid-70s, I started reading the work of W. Edwards Deming, the famous statistician who taught so much to the Japanese about improving their productivity and competitiveness. Then Helen and I took a trip to Japan and Korea, which got me thinking about a whole bunch of different things we could do to improve our company. That's probably when I first began thinking about some of the very real ways that we could improve our teamwork and put more authority in the hands of our people in the stores. Our most famous technique for doing this is a textbook example of thinking small. We call it store within a store. And it's the simplest idea in the world. Again, in many big retail companies, the department head is just an hourly employee going through the motions, somebody who punches a clock, then rips open boxes and stacks whatever's in them onto shelves. But we give our department heads the opportunity to become real merchants at a very early stage of the game. They can have the pride of proprietorship, even if they weren't fortunate enough to go to college or to be formally trained in business. They only have to want it bad enough, pay close attention, and work very hard at developing merchandising skills. We've had many cases where the experience has fired people up with ambition, and they've gone on to work their way through college and move on up in the company. And I hope we have many more cases like that. Again, this only works because we decided a long time ago to share so much information about the company with our associates, rather than keep everything secretive. In store within a store, we make our department heads the managers of their own businesses. And in some cases, these businesses are actually bigger in annual sales than a lot of our first Walmart stores were. We share everything with them, the cost of their goods, the freight costs, the profit margins. We let them see how their store ranks with every other store in the company on a constant running basis, and we give them incentives to want to win. We're always trying for that fine balance between autonomy and control. Like any big retailer, Walmart obviously has certain procedures which we require our stores to follow, or items they must stock. But we have taken steps to make sure our stores have some autonomy. The responsibility for ordering merchandise lies with the department head. The responsibility for promoting merchandise is with the store manager. Our buyers have much more responsibility for deciding what's carried in our stores than buyers at most other companies. We run them hard, and we give them a tough time, because we don't want them getting a big head and thinking they're all-powerful. But the fact is that our buyers, just like our folks in the stores, are in unique positions of authority for the retail business. Force ideas to bubble up. This goes hand in hand with pushing responsibility down. We're always looking for new ways to encourage our associates out in the stores to push their ideas up through the system. We do a lot of this at Saturday morning meetings. We'll invite associates who have thought up something that's really worked well for their store, a particular item or a particular display, to come share those ideas with us. The VPI, Volume Producing Item Contest, is a perfect example of how we put this into practice. Everybody from the department manager level on up can choose an item of merchandise they want to promote, with big displays or whatever. And then we see whose item produces the highest volume. I've always thought of the VPI contest not just as a way to stimulate sales, but as a method of teaching our associates how to become better merchants, to show them what can be done by picking an item that's available and figuring out a creative way to sell it, or buy it, or both. It gives them the opportunity to act the way we used to in the early days. They can do crazy things, like pick an item and hang it all over a tree filled with stuffed monkeys in the middle of the store, or drive a pickup truck into Action Alley and fill it with car washing sponges. We're not just looking for merchandising ideas from our associates. Our latest effort is a program called Yes We Can, Sam, which, by the way, I did not name. Again, we invite hourly associates who have come up with money savings ideas to attend our Saturday morning meeting. So far, we figure we've saved about $8 million a year off these ideas. And most of them are just common-sense kinds of things that nobody picks up on when we're all thinking about how big we are. They're the kinds of things that come from thinking small. One of my favorites came from an hourly associate in our traffic department who got to wondering why we were shipping all the fixtures we bought for our warehouses by common carrier when we own the largest private fleet of trucks in America. She figured out a program to backhaul those things on our own trucks and saved us over $500,000 right there. So we brought her in, recognized her good thinking, and gave her a cash award. When you consider that there are 400,000 of us, it's obvious that there are more than a few good ideas out there waiting to be plucked. Tom Coughlin. Let me tell you how Walmart came to have people greeters. Back in 1980, Mr. Walton and I went into a Walmart in Crowley, Louisiana. The first thing we saw as we opened the door was this older gentleman standing there. The man didn't know me, and he didn't see Sam, but he said, "Hi, how are you? Glad you're here. If there's anything I can tell you about our store, just let me know." Neither Sam nor I had ever seen such a thing, so we started talking to him. Well, once he got over the fact that he was talking to the chairman, he explained that he had a dual purpose: to make people feel good about coming in, and to make sure people weren't walking back out the entrance with merchandise they hadn't paid for. The store, it turned out, had had trouble with shoplifting, and its manager was an old-line merchant named Dan McAllister, who knew how to take care of his inventory. He didn't want to intimidate the honest customers by posting a guard at the door, but he wanted to leave a clear message that if you came in and stole, someone was there who would see it. Well, Sam thought that was the greatest idea he'd ever heard of. He went right back to Bentonville and told everyone we ought to put greeters at the front of every single store. A lot of people thought he'd lost his mind. Our folks felt that putting someone at the door was a waste of money. They just couldn't see what Sam and Dan McAllister were seeing: that the greeter sent a warm, friendly message to the good customer and a warning to the thief. They fought him all the way on it. Some people tried hard to talk him out of it. They tried to ignore it. Sam just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. Every week, every meeting, he'd talk about greeters. He'd throw fits whenever he went into a store and didn't find one. Gradually, he wore everyone down and got his way. I'd say it took about a year and a half because they really resisted it. But Sam was relentless. I guess his vindication had to be the day in 1989 when he walked into a Kmart in Illinois and found that they had installed people greeters at their front doors. If people greeters were the only good idea I'd picked up from the associates in the stores over the years, I'd still say that visiting the stores and listening to our folks was one of the most valuable uses of my time as an executive. But really, our best ideas usually do come from the folks in the stores, period. I should say, though, that the people greeters were an exception in that I'm not generally disposed to ideas that require adding on people and expenses. Stay lean. Fight bureaucracy. Anytime a company grows as fast as Walmart has, pockets of duplication are going to build up, and there will be areas of the business which we may no longer need. No boss or employee really likes to dwell on such matters. It's only human nature not to want to have your job, or the jobs of the people who work for you, eliminated. But it is absolutely the responsibility of a company's top management to be thinking about this issue all the time, to ensure a sound future for the overall company. Now, one way I've approached this is by sticking to the same formula I used back when we had about 5 stores. In those days, I tried to operate on a 2% general office expense structure. In other words, 2% of sales should have been enough to carry our buying office, our general office expense, my salary, Bud's salary, and after we started adding district managers or any other officers, their salaries too. Believe it or not, we haven't changed that basic formula from 5 stores to 2,000 stores. In fact, we are actually operating at a far lower percentage today in office overhead than we did 30 years ago. And that includes tremendous expenses for computer support and distribution center support, though not the actual cost of running the distribution centers. Really, it includes everything that we supply centrally in the way of support for the stores. Some folks in the retail business